Welcome to Little Atoms on Resonance 104.4 FM, a live talk show based around ideas of the Enlightenment.
Little Atoms is presented by Neil Denny, Padraig Reedy, Richard Saunderson, and Rebecca Watson, as well as regular mystery guest presenters.
Little Atoms makes no claims to balance. We actively promote science, freedom of expression, skepticism, and secular humanism. This means we can often end up talking about superstition, religious fundamentalism, censorship, and conspiracy theory.
Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting. Good evening, welcome to another edition of Little Atoms. Tonight we've me, Neil Denny, and as our guest this evening, the historian Edward Valence. Edward Valence is a reader in early modern history at Roehampton University. After reading history at Balliol College, Oxford, he was Develling Willis Research Fellow at the University of Sheffield. He writes a historical blog, which you can find at edwardvalence.wordpress.com. And he's a regular contributor to The New Statesman and BBC History magazine. Edward Valence's books include The Glorious Revolution and, most recently, A Radical History of Britain.
Ted, thanks for joining us on Little Atoms today.
My pleasure.
So we're going to be talking about your book, A Radical History of Britain. The book describes the various historical events and characters associated with radical movements throughout the British history. But it also has sort of a connecting theme, which is this idea that there is a sort of thread of radicalism that runs through history. It is somehow connected. Could you perhaps elaborate on that a little?
Yeah, sure. I mean, a couple of things sparked off writing this book. The first one was Gordon Brown's speech. Remember him? Yeah, Gordon Brown. Talking about a golden thread of a struggle for liberty in this country and tying this in with sort of repackaging a sense of Britishness as about values of fairness and tolerance and so on. So that was one thing. And then the other thing was the Guardian newspaper running this competition over most... I mean, it's a strange thing because it was a competition on a popular vote of the most sort of forgotten moment in British history. I think, how can one win it with the most votes if it's forgotten? Anyway, very interesting in terms of lots of things like Peterloo, the Putney debates coming through as sort of moments that people felt were really important in British history and needed to be celebrated but were not being kind of celebrated at the moment. And that really sparked off thinking about this idea of a radical tradition and why it's still quite a powerful idea in terms not just of sort of British history, but in terms of British politics as well, particularly left-wing British politics now and the Labour tradition. And so what I wanted to do in the book was look at that idea of a tradition and investigate how far there is this sort of tradition there, whether we really do see radical movements, if you like, kind of passing the baton from one to another, or whether this is more of a fabricated tradition, whether it's something that's actually more of a recent invention.
You've already just raised this point, but I mean, it's certainly true that in modern times, left-wing political movements are the ones that have basically taken on the mantle of what they would describe as radical movements, and any sort of right-wing radical movements have sort of, you know, been to the left out in the cold. And there's a great illustration of this. There's something you describe called Levellers Day, which is not a celebration of crusty folk rock, but Levellers political movement. So tell us about that. It's an interesting story.
Well, Levellers Day celebrates... I mean, it's an odd sort of celebration. It's more of a commemoration because it's keys in with the suppression of the Leveller mutiny at Burford. And this is when three soldiers were executed by firing squad who had been part of this mutiny. They didn't want to go over to fight in Cromwell's campaigns in Ireland. And inspired by Leveller ideas as well, they were mutinying against Cromwell's leadership of the army. So since the mid-70s, it basically started with some Workers' Education Association guys in Oxfordshire starting up this festival. And they then asked Tony Benn to get involved, Tony Benn then being a cabinet minister. And this obviously attracted a great deal of publicity, left-wing cabinet minister coming to Oxfordshire to celebrate, you know, this moment in English radical history. And there was actually quite a lot of opposition from local people and local conservatives. Douglas Hurd, I think, got involved as well, asking what, you know, a busy cabinet minister was doing, coming to Oxfordshire, doing this thing. And local conservative association tried all sorts of tricks to try and ban it. They tried to hold jumble sales on the same day to ensure that the Burford Church was actually booked out, so they couldn't use it. But it's been going since the mid-70s and attracts kind of, you know, familiar figures from, you know, left-wing British politics. Billy Bragg often goes there and does things. And in fact, the Levellers themselves have been there and done sort of acoustic sets there too. So, I mean, it's an interesting kind of one for looking at this, because it's sort of, it's odd that that has been celebrated since the 70s rather than, say, Putney. Mm-hmm. Putney has only recently got its sort of exhibition centre. And if you think about it, Putney is really more of a triumphal moment. Yeah. It's a moment where the Levellers are really coming close to influence. Whereas Burford is a moment where this is, you know, the end point of really the Levellers having kind of significant influence. These mutinies are being crushed. The Leveller leaders are in prison. So it's sort of celebrating defeat.
But yeah, we do like a loser, though.
Yeah, so. Yeah. But I think there is this sense in which the left wing likes to celebrate these moments of defeat, because yeah. You can kind of comfort yourself by saying, well, of course we're right, but the reason why we're never successful is because, you know, there's these bastards out there who are always suppressing us. So it's a way of telling yourself that, you know, we're in the right, but inevitably, you know, we're always too far ahead of our time and people are never ready to accept our ideas.
Let's go back to a point that we could consider as sort of year zero for the civil liberties movement. Mm. Something that's often raised and has been throughout history and is still today is the idea of Magna Carta.
Sure.
And indeed, you know, during the you know, Tony Blair's reign, it was often reigned when, you know, talking about reference to the war on terror, for instance.
So
perhaps we should talk about something that's often raised but perhaps little understood. So we should talk about what Magna Carta actually is and why it was significant.
Yeah, well, I mean, Magna Carta in the first instance was a very short-lived truce thrashed out between King John and his barons in 1215. And the reason why it's called Magna Carta is because it's a very, very lengthy document. So I can't off the top of my head summarise everything for you. And a lot of it is would seem rather kind of esoteric in terms of its relationship to a history of British liberty or radicalism, in that it's about things like fishing rights and, you know, preservation of weirs and so on. But there's important stuff in there as well about, for example, the rule of law, about the monarch's authority. It's mainly remembered as being this moment where the kind of the powers of the monarch are kind of clipped, if you like. But actually, that element of the 1215 Magna Carta is something that is not sustained in subsequent versions of the Charter, the versions that actually go into English law. Those parts are left out, partly because they would pretty much be unworkable in any kind of monarchical system of government, because basically it meant that any time, you know, the king's barons decided that they didn't like what the king was doing, they could basically, you know, effectively overthrow him. And no kind of sensible reigning monarch is going to assent to those kinds of terms. But of course, there's it's Cap 29, which is the key part of it, which seems to enshrine this idea of equality before the law, due process, that the people should not be exiled or imprisoned without due process being observed. And it's that bit that, in the words of one historian, has kind of almost gone beyond the kind of language of history into something that's sort of ingrained into our political culture as, you know, as the sort of fundamental right.
And interesting, although of course we don't have a written constitution in Britain, but you know, this is something that's been basically almost word for word into the constitutions of various places around the world.
Yes, it has become, you know, in a very real sense, a global document as a result of obviously Britain's empire. It's become part of, you know, Canadian, Indian, Malaysian constitutions as well. And obviously it's had an influence in terms of the United States constitution too. So it's been a very influential document. The problem, I think, is what we, you know, particularly you raised its use in discussion of the war on terror, and it became very much a sort of an emblem of that debate over 42-day detention. And the problem is, really, that people were, like Tony Benn, like David Davis, were talking about this kind of assault on Magna Carta. And there's a fundamental misunderstanding here of what actually the remaining parts of Magna Carta actually guarantee. If Parliament decides that people can be detained for 42 days without charge, then Magna Carta in no way countermands that. It simply says that, you know, what the, you know, law is what people, you know, is how people should be treated in terms of, you know, imprisonment and so forth. So if Parliament has legislated that 42-day detention is okay, then Magna Carta doesn't countermand that in any way. And of course, we've already seen how this works out in those cases in the War on Terror, and also in the case which I raised in the book of the Chagos Islanders, mm-hmm. who were, you know, expelled from their homeland, and various lawyers tried to, you know, use Magna Carta because they're British citizens, to use this as a way of saying, look, these people have been exiled against their will to Mauritius, and it just doesn't work because the legislation governing the British Indian Ocean Territory says that the governor can do that. So there's no problem as far as Magna Carta is concerned.
Let's perhaps move on to look at some of the examples of the radical movements that you talk about then. And as we've said, there's a tendency to look for modern times and see these movements as sort of antecedents of the sort of modern civil rights movements and fighting for things like equality, universal suffrage and stuff. So let's actually see how well some of these things perhaps hold up, look through that prism. So there's various peasants' revolts that you talk about to begin with. So let's look at some of those. People will know some of these names, like Wat Tyler, for instance, the leader. So let's talk about what these peasants' revolts actually achieved.
Anything. Well, I think, you know, they do achieve something quite significant, and they are significant in terms of the history of, you know, liberty and freedom in our country. Perhaps not in the way in which is usually understood. There's a sense in which the peasants' revolt in particular is celebrated as a great kind of anti-monarchical moment. You know, this is the people revolting against their sovereign. But in fact, you know, most of the statements that, as far as we can tell, made from the rebels in 1381 are monarchist. They are, you know, they're appealing to Richard to solve their problems. It's not a proto-republican uprising. This is not what they're angry about. They're angry about the king's ministers, who they see as being exploitative and, you know, imposing these unpopular taxes like the poll tax upon the people.
The obvious parallel that people will be familiar with is like Robin Hood, who is, you know, an aristocrat who's fighting to overthrow one king to reintroduce another king.
Yes, and this sense of a kind of sort of rough sort of social justice, robbing from the rich and giving to the poor. But they are historically significant, I think, in a way that kind of gets overlooked, in that they are important in terms of moving our country from a feudal society to a society where most people are actually free labourers and not serfs. And they are significant, actually, in challenging vassalage, in challenging that form of kind of bound labour. Increasingly, you know, because of the threat of popular rebellion, mass popular rebellion in our country, landholders became much, much more reluctant, you know, wary about kind of exacting too much from their labourers. So they are significant. And also, the thing that's sort of forgotten too is the extent to which this was a peasants' rebellion. Should be seen as a peasants' rebellion in inverted commas. Already a lot of the people involved in this rebellion are not serfs, they are free men. So the question has to be asked why they're using this language of bondage, of vassalage, of serfdom. And it's because of things like Magna Carta, it's because of that 13th century inheritance. Already people are thinking in these broader terms about freedom, about liberty. And that carries on through things like Hayes Rebellion, through things like Kett's Rebellion, as we now call it, the Commotion Time. This stronger, broader language of liberty that starts to come through these documents.
There's this idea of the Norman yoke the true born Englishman are somehow under the control of the French, but there's another thing that starts to come out in here, which is this idea that they seem quite insular and they one of the aspects is attacking outsiders, and there's a scene where a load of Flemish merchants are massacred.
Yes. I mean, there are deeply and unpopular, unpleasant aspects to that's, you know, let's not mince words about it. It's pretty gruesome stuff, the things that most medieval rebels get up to. And obviously, there, as you say, there are, particularly in 1381, moments where outsider groups are particularly targeted. We don't see that so much in, for example, the Commotion Time later on. But there are elements of that too in actually in leveller rhetoric in the 1640s. 1940s, you mentioned this language of free-born Englishmen. That's something that comes out strongly through Leveller writing, and you can argue that that has an unpleasant ethnic dimension to it too. There's a lot of work now on the Civil War as an ethnic struggle, mm-hmm. as well, with a kind of royalist Celtic fringe against a kind of Little England parliamentarian, you know, force on the other side. So there can be these unpleasant ethnic dimensions to this rhetoric too there. You're right, yeah.
You're listening to Little Atoms. Today with me, Neil Denny, and I'm talking to Ted Valance about his book, A Radical History of Britain. I want to jump forward a little bit now and look at a figure who's quite significant to this programme and to listeners of this programme, and that's Tom Paine.
Mm.
But I'd like to sort of look at, you talk about the sort of radicalism of that time and characters like Paine and Mary Wollstonecraft, for instance.
Yeah.
But in the background, there is the French Revolution's going on.
Yeah.
And the French Revolution descends into the Great Terror.
Yes.
And so let's look about how that had an effect on the acceptance of British radicalism at that time.
Yeah, it has a very significant effect upon it. And one of the problems for Paine in particular is how closely he has tied himself to the revolutionary process in France itself. Obviously, in personal terms, it becomes problematic for him because he becomes a delegate to the National Assembly and then himself gets in trouble because he opposes the execution of Louis XVI and ends up in prison as a mm-hmm. result of that. But it's important in broader terms for radicalism in Britain because Paineite radicalism becomes very much attached to a kind of treacherous Francophilia. And for that reason, radicals in Britain have to kind of change tack and have to change the rhetoric they're using to emphasise instead a much more kind of homegrown radicalism, to emphasise Anglo-Saxon symbols instead of sort of looking across the channel to France. Because conservatives can always say, well, if you want reform or if you want radical change, it's going to lead to mass murder, it's going to lead to this mass bloodletting, this chaos, this horror, you know. So it becomes something that really changes the language and the nature of British radicalism in the 19th century.
OK, I wanted to finish off, explore a group that, again, is quite relevant to the themes that we explore on this programme. And this is the movement of Chartism.
Mm.
And what immediately leaps out from today's perspective, well, two things, actually. First of all, that, hey, we now have fixed-term parliaments.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
The thing that really stands out from today's perspective is how harshly the Chartists were treated for what seemed today to be incredibly mild demands, really.
Yes, it's incredible, really, when you look at it. But, you made that modern analogy, and I was actually talking about this the other day, and what's interesting to me is Nick Clegg used 1832 as a watershed and saying, you know, this coalition government's going to be this sort of watershed moment as well. What's interesting is the way in which the radical agenda in Britain doesn't change at all, really, between, you know, post-Waterloo up to 1848 and Kennington Common. It's the same 6 points mm-hmm. of the charting, you know, secret ballot, manhood suffrage, etc., etc. And it seems to us now incredibly kind of sensible, reasonable things to demand. But there were no changes as a result of 1832 because nothing that had happened in terms of reform at the centre in any way kind of, you know, really responded to that, what seems to us a very kind of reasonable agenda, and didn't really respond to tactics that were also incredibly, for the most part, reasonable in the sense of mass petitioning, mass demonstrations, the use of the press, and so forth. It's, you know, we have this debate in the history about the physical force element of Chartism, and that's often something that comes to the fore. But really, it's not really... It's wrong to see this as sort of in terms of a radical wing of Chartism that was threatening. It was something that was quite central to a lot of Chartist rhetoric in the sense of saying, well, look, you know, throughout our history, there has been an ultimate right, if you kind of like, sort of self-defence for the people. But that's a different thing from saying that the Chartists were sort of insurrectionists. That's really a very kind of marginal thing. I mean, the one example that sort of people would bring out sort of, I guess, to challenge that would be the Newport Rising. But it's not really an insurrection. It's actually a jailbreak. It's an mm-hmm. attempt to break out some Chartist prisoners. It's not really an attempt to sort of, you know, a serious attempt to overthrow the British state by force.
What are the other groups that people will most likely be familiar with that's around at the same time and connected is the Tolpoddle Martyrs.
Mm.
And again, what's interesting, what I think is fascinating that comes out of the book is the extent to which they're often seen as being the sort of first trade unionists.
Yes.
But this clearly wasn't the case. I mean, trade unionism was quite common at the time.
Yeah.
They were almost arbitrarily picked on.
Yes, they are. I mean, they're used as whipping boys, basically, to sort of crush a resurgence of sort of trade associations and nascent trade unions. So they're significant in the sense that the furore over their treatment does re-energise the trade union movement. But they're certainly not, you know, the first trade unionists. And they wouldn't have been picked on, you know, if they were, I think, because they were, you know, a set of Pacific Methodists for the most part. They weren't necessarily the best kind of example to pick on, but they are significant in terms of re-energising trade unionism, if not as kind of the first trade unionists. And significant, as you mentioned as well, because of their connections to the Charters movement, which actually gets strengthened by the fact that they are picked upon by the government as sort of whipping boys.
Another name that's familiar from the radical past to most people will be that of Ned Ludd. Although I say a name, he wasn't actually a historical figure called Ned Ludd. But it's used now as a pejorative term to describe, you know, people that are somehow scared of technology.
Yes.
But let's talk about who the Luddites were and what they actually did and what was sort of going on at the time.
Well, essentially, Luddism arose as a response to increasing mechanisation in the early 19th century and the movement away from hand-woven or sort of small-scale cottage weaving towards mass mechanised looms. And so the Luddites were involved in machine breaking across the industrial northwest and across the Midlands as well. The thing about the association between Luddism and a kind of sort of retrograde anti-technology outlook is that it's not really a fair characterization of the Luddites themselves. They were actually quite selective in terms of the machinery they were destroying. What they were trying to destroy mainly were the machines that made very kind of cheap, kind of shoddy, if you like, the kind of new look clothing of its day. I mean, unfair to the new look. I'm sure they make some excellent clothes. Let's just put that in. But let's say that they were kind of targeting, you know, very poorly produced stockings and so on, and trying to, if you like, maintain a sort of higher quality, more expensive, obviously, kind of produced goods there, and sort of keep that industry going. So it wasn't completely indiscriminate. Is the thing, you know, to get across with this. The thing that people often aren't aware of, as well, is just the kind of the scale of this machine breaking activity. The military force that was used to try and successfully to suppress this activity was larger than the military force that was on the Iberian Peninsula to fight Napoleon's forces. This was, you know, a massive military operation. And as well as that, you had a lot of factory owners who were basically raising their own private armies to defend their factories from, you know, assault by Luddite insurrectionists. So it's an incredibly sort of, you know, violent period in our history. It also has, you know, it's not just about the economics of it. There's clear connections here, particularly in the northwest, with radical ideology too. There's a lot of evidence of the influence of kind of radical ideas amongst Luddites in the northwest, in particular.
In terms of a modern parallel, you know, you mentioned New Look. Perhaps we could sort of, in a good way, link the Luddites, the historical Luddites, to like the anti-globalisation movement.
Yeah, I think you can. I think that's, you know, another way of thinking about it. Not just the sort of, you know, people who are kind of fighting, you know, the relentless tide, the inevitable tide of technological change. These are people who are wanting to make some, you know, genuine points about, you know, working conditions and the kind of world that we want to live in, the quality of things that we want to own. You know, I mean, you're talking about an early 19th century kind of attempt to reverse the disposable society and just everything cheap, and let's just sort of make, you know, pay people rubbish wages, and so they can only afford rubbish quality goods. I mean, this is, you know, this is a point that they're making in time. And there's what people forget as well, there's a lot of connections between these movements, the early Chartist movement, and abolitionist movements too. You know, that they were trying to, the people who were harvesting the cotton in the southern United States, which was getting taken over to be woven in, you know, in factories in Manchester and so on, those factory workers in Manchester were also campaigning for the rights of those slaves in the southern United States too. So there was this kind of global vision to radicalism as well, and this connection between, you know, wage slavery in the United Kingdom and chattel slavery in the southern United States.
To finish off then, let's look at, and perhaps a bit naughty question to put you on the spot here, but let's look at sort of like radical movements now and perhaps how they might have inherited some of the traits.
Yeah.
Do you think there are any? I mean, do you think radicalism is healthy at the moment? Or?
I think there is a lot of kind of activity going on at the moment. I don't know whether I think we can characterise it as radical, because I think there's a lot still of disenchantment with mainstream politics. I don't think that's going to change enormously because of the coalition. And the interesting thing is the way in which a lot of these groups are kind of re-engaging with our radical past. Thinking here of the way in which the anti-Heathrow demonstrators and so on were appropriating kind of suffragette imagery, this suffragette dress in the way that in their campaigns there. So I think there has been a kind of re-engagement with our radical history in terms of protests that are going on at the moment. And I don't think that, you know, what we're getting in terms of the coalition is going to kind of... I don't think we're going to see that as a kind of way in which sort of any sort of reforming energies are sort of dissipated because of that. Because really, anyone with any sense is going to look at what we're actually getting. You mentioned fixed-term parliaments, but if you look at it, we're actually getting less than we would have got if... you know, a majority Labour government had been elected. So the terms of reform here are pretty mild. We're getting things that people have been arguing for since the mid-17th century. Fixed-term parliaments are things that the Levellers were arguing for in the mid-17th century. So I don't think there's any sense in which people are going to feel satisfied with what the coalition is doing. But I think there is a sense in which there's a kind of heightened expectancy. And there's been a lot of talk about change, a lot of talk about radical change. The word radical has been massively overused, I think, by Cameron and Clegg in particular. And that does ramp up expectations, I think. The people are going to expect more than they've been offered so far. And I think that may actually, you know, open the way for groups that are more at the fringe of British politics to get their voices heard, to sort of raise awareness, to increase the membership of these groups.
You've been listening to Little Atoms. We've been talking about A Radical History of Britain by Edward Vallance, and it's out now from Abacus Books. Ted, thanks for speaking to us today.
Thank you. Cheers.
You've been listening to Little Atoms. You can find details of upcoming guests on our website, littleatoms.com. The Little Atoms podcast is available on iTunes. Thanks for listening.